Civil Subcommittee of the Judiciary is now in session. We have before us this morning Senate Bill 171. And I'm going to have the following three people come forward to begin the discussion. Carl Bajeri, Ken Sherman, and Susan Grady.
We just lost Ken, but he'll be back in a minute.
Just lost Ken? Okay.
I suppose I'll start, and Ken will be with us in just a moment. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carl Bajeri. I'm an associate professor of law at the University of Oregon. I specialize in the field of commercial law and in particular in the Uniform Commercial Code. For over 7 years, I've been directly involved in the processes, the nationwide and the statewide processes that have provided the foundation of SB 171. SB 171 would enact revisions to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. These revisions would bring important benefits to the economy of the state. The Uniform Commercial Code, or the UCC, is a careful and comprehensive set of statutes that governs a substantial variety of business transactions. UCC Article 9, with which SB 171 is concerned, is the portion of the UCC that governs secured transactions, which is to say, loans in which the borrower gives collateral to the lender to help assure the lender of being repaid on the loan. Article 9 is already in effect in Oregon and has been since 1961. It was amended once in 1973, and SB 171 would revise it again more thoroughly to bring it up to date for our modern economy. My colleague Ken Sherman will testify about the substance of these revisions, but before he does that, I'd like to provide some context for that substance. The UCC, including Article 9, has been adopted not only by Oregon, but also independently by all the rest of the 50 states, and even by other U.S. jurisdictions such as Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. As the word uniform implies, the Uniform Commercial Code provides substantially the same rules of law in Oregon as in Washington or California or any of the other 50-plus enacting jurisdictions. This uniformity is crucial in our modern economy because business transactions that are covered by the UCC cross state lines so frequently. Increasingly, over the past few decades, it's routine for a borrower to be in a different state from his or her lender. And if this mere difference in location, this crossing of state lines, automatically carried with it a difference in state law, people would be much less able to transact business across state lines. The legalities would simply be too complicated. As a result, the economy would suffer because people would simply have fewer choices in whom to do business with. So the uniformity of law that flows from the Uniform Commercial Code has been a brilliant and very successful way of keeping that problem from arising. Now, of course, each state has its own sovereign powers and its own responsibility to ensure that the laws that it adopts are sound. Over the decades, and now in the case of SB 171, these important state concerns have been very successfully reconciled with the goal of uniformity in business transactions. The way that this reconciliation between sovereignty and uniformity has been achieved is very important. I'd like to ask you to spend a couple of minutes thinking about it with me. You may already be generally familiar with the uniform laws process from other statutes, but even so, the details of how it has operated as background for SB 171 are important. Each state, including Oregon, appoints its own commissioners on uniform state laws. Currently, Oregon's commissioners on uniform state laws are three prominent lawyers, Joe Willis, Oglesby Young, and Martha Walters. I believe that Greg Chamoff, the legislative counsel, is an ex officio member of the Commission on Uniform State Laws. The Oregon commissioners, along with the commissioners from all the other U.S. jurisdictions, act together in a body known as the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which we call NCUSL for short. This nationally representative body, which has operated for 110 years, is one of the two sponsors of the UCC. The other sponsor of the UCC is the American Law Institute, or the ALI, which has been in existence for 77 years. It's composed of distinguished judges, lawyers, and professors of law. Together, these two bodies have cooperated for decades in keeping the UCC up to date. They do this by conducting studies of commercial law. When they believe it's appropriate, they jointly appoint and approve drafting committees to draft changes to the UCC, which then are proposed to the 50 states for adoption. The drafting process that's run by NACUSL and the ALI is open to the public. Experts and others are actively solicited and actively participate. Over 10 years ago, in 1990, NACUSL and the ALI began to study whether changes would be advisable to Article 9 of the UCC. In due course, NACUSL and the ALI appointed a drafting committee to begin working on the changes that they had concluded were necessary. It was at this point that I became personally involved with what today has become SB 171. Along with the drafting committee and dozens of other experts, I actively participated in a years-long series of meetings held several times per year in major cities across the country, each one lasting fully 2.5 days. In the course of these meetings, every idea in the proposed revisions was openly, actively, and thoroughly debated. While this process was going on, NACUSL and the ALI were overseeing the drafting committee's work, debating the evolving product, and giving directions to the drafting committee. The American Bar Association also took an active role in the process. After approximately 5 years of drafting committee work, the draft was resubmitted to NACUSL and the ALI for a final careful review and then formally approved by both of those organizations. At that point, this is 1999 now, the work on this subject shifted from NACUSL and the ALI to Oregon and the other states of the Union, because every state needs to take the uniform law proposal and carefully integrate it into the other statutes of that state. For this purpose, the Oregon State Bar organized a work group under the leadership of Susan Evans Gravy, who's sitting on my left. Susan will describe the functioning of the work group in a little more detail, but I would just like to state here that it was composed of a broad base of Oregon's experts on secured transactions. The work group met and worked actively for approximately a full year, both as a whole and in various committees. The result of these 10 years of labor is SB 171. I must say that it's a product that fully justifies the labor that went into it. It's careful, thoughtful, and extraordinarily well designed. It provides the uniformity that a healthy nationwide economy demands. And at the same time, thanks to the Oregon State Bar Work Group, it's seamlessly well integrated with Oregon's existing statutes. In a handful of instances, SB 171 departs from the uniform provisions recommended by NACUSL and the ALI. And to the extent we have time, I know that Mr. Sherman and I would be glad to address some of these non-uniformities if you're interested. But for the most part, the non-uniformities are quite small and quite unimportant part of the bill. In volume as well as importance, I would roughly estimate that the non-uniformities are about 0.5% of the entire statute. The same is true in other states, by the way. Counterparts of SB 171 have already been enacted in well over half the states of the Union, 29 as of last week, I believe. And in each of those states, the non-uniformities are quite small. The reason for this is that although each state has power to depart from the recommendations of NACUSL and the ALI, each state benefits by participating in the same unified economy as its sister states. And for this reason, each state has a natural incentive to stay very, very close to the uniform version. Now, not only have half the states, or more than half the states, already enacted bills like SB 171, but also each of the remaining U.S. jurisdictions is expected to act its own counterpart of SB 171 within the next very few months. Specifically, all states are making a concerted effort to enact bills like this by July 1st of this year. The reason for this July 1st date comes back to the fact that each state's economy is so heavily intertwined with the economy of every other state. NACUSL, the ALI, the members of the Oregon State Bar Work Group, and every commentator I know of all concur that unless all the states make the transition from current UCC Article 9 to revised UCC Article 9 on the same date, borrowing and lending transactions throughout the nation could be substantially disrupted. So July 1st is the date that has been agreed on nationwide and that we're all working to. But you'll note that Section 198, that's the very last section of the bill, if I recall, provides for the bill to be effective on that date. The state of Oregon has an excellent record of acting responsibly to keep its Uniform Commercial Code up to date. In recent years, after processes very similar to the one I've described for UCC Article 9, NACUSL and the ALI have sponsored amendments to several other articles of the UCC. And Oregon has adopted those amendments in a timely way, also without large non-uniformities. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I respectfully urge you to continue this tradition to bring this 10-year process to a successful conclusion by promptly enacting SB 171.
Thank you. Anyone have any question of Mr. Bergeri this time? Okay. Thank you. You may proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Susan Evans Gravy, and I am a public affairs attorney with Oregon State Bar. And I was just going to go briefly through the work group and the process we went through, the people who were involved, and then I will turn it over to Mr. Sherman to go through the details of the bill. As Mr. Bier mentioned earlier, the Uniform State Laws Commissioners, Martha Walters, Oglesby Young, and Joe Willis, did bring up this bill, brought it to our attention in 1999 as something that should be enacted. Both the Bar and the Bankers Association and others felt it was important that the bill be walked through all the specific provisions carefully before it was introduced. So we asked them to put off introduction until we had had an opportunity to work through the bill. So what we did is in November of 1999, we formed a work group. We brought together under the auspices of the Oregon State Bar a number of specialists in the area of secure transactions to try and work through the bill. A number of those participants remained active in the work group process. There were approximately 40 people involved. Some of those people included the bankers, the Credit Union League, County Clerks Association, Concentrics Incorporated, Secretary of State's Office, Public Affairs Council, who was working with Les Schwab, Municipal Finance and Bonding Representatives, a number of the sections of the Oregon State Bar, Debtor Creditor and Consumer Law Section, representatives from the Agricultural Cooperative Council of Oregon, the Collectors Association, Mortgage Bankers Association, Financial Services Associations, and others. And if I've left anybody out, please ask for their indulgence, but they are listed in our minutes in terms of who was involved in the process. We think it was a broad representative process, and we tried to cover as many of the issues that we possibly could. However, as is the case with any large piece of legislation, there are things that come up after the fact, which also will be addressed by Mr. Sherman in his testimony. A few issues have come up. The work group did operate on a consensus basis with everyone involved. We did have a few initial things that we talked about. For instance, we tried to track on existing Oregon law and the existing version of UCC Article 9. As we all know, any uniform law is not necessarily uniform. There are minor revisions that are made just to conform with the form and style of the statutes in the particular state. And in Oregon, that is definitely the case. There were also some additional issues that we did decide to make some changes to the Uniform Act in order to make sure that the statute conformed to the existing version of Article 9 that was adopted in Oregon as well as existing Oregon law. Some of those were issues that we formed subcommittees on to go through in detail what the specific issues were to be considered. And those subcommittees were the Agricultural Liens Committee, the filing issues for the Secretary of State's office, consumer issues, and then we had a miscellaneous subcommittee that dealt with a lot of different issues from municipal finance, bonding issues, accessions issues, and the assignability issues that will come up later on in more detail in Mr. Sherman's testimony. So that's kind of the framework for the way the committee operated or the work group functioned through the entire year. We met for almost a year, perhaps a little bit longer. Subcommittees met in between full committee meetings, and our ultimate goal was to make sure we had a good product to introduce for the 2001 session, especially in light of the fact that there's a July 1, 2001 effective date for the bill on a national level, and we were working towards that goal. The Public Affairs Committee of the Oregon State Bar has been involved in the process insofar as they've monitored what's been going on and has reiterated its support for the proposal as it's moved through the process and the work of the work group on UCC Article 9. At this point, unless there are some questions that you might have for me, I will turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Okay, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. Along with 30 to 40 other individuals, I served for the last 15 months on the work group that Susan has described that was assembled by the Oregon State Bar to put the NACUSL draft of Article 9 into Oregon bill form. Let me just say for the record that the Oregon Bankers Association supports the enactment of this important measure. My testimony this morning is going to fall into four parts: an overview of Article 9, a description of the most important changes that revised Article 9 would make from our current version of that article, the highlights of the changes that our work group recommends be made from the uniform NACUSL draft, and finally comments regarding proposed amendments to Senate Bill 171. Professor Beer has described the Uniform Commercial Code as the central and the central role that it plays in our commercial law, and Article 9 in many ways may be the most important of the articles of the Uniform Commercial Code. Most of us have mortgages on our houses and loans against our automobiles. The availability of credit, both for business and consumers, allows us to acquire and use and enjoy things that we could otherwise not afford to buy for cash. Credit fuels our economy and not incidentally gives banks that make up the Oregon Bankers Association a reason for being. Article 9 provides a legal framework within which credit may be extended to business and consumers on a secured basis using the debtor's personal property as the security. Security interest is probably the most important term in Article 9. Interestingly, this term is not defined in Article 9, but rather in Article 1 of the UCC, which is ORS Chapter 71 in the Oregon law. Security interest means an interest in personal property or fixtures which secures the payment or performance of an obligation. Article 9 is the rule book on personal property security interests, how to establish them, how to give them priority over other interests in the same property, how to extend the periods of their effectiveness, how to enforce them, how to terminate them when they are no longer needed. Before we get into the details of Article 9, there are a few other key terms that need to be defined. Creditor is a term that isn't defined in Article 9, but I'm going to use it here today in my testimony. By creditor, I mean someone to whom an obligation is owed. This may be an obligation to pay money, or it may be an obligation to perform some other act. Debtor means a person who owns or has some lesser interest in personal property that is being used as collateral to secure a debt or other obligation. Usually the debtor will be the person who owes the debt or the obligation to the creditor, but in some cases, such as where a parent puts up security for a child's obligation, the collateral is owned by person A, in this case the parent, and is used to secure the debt of person B, the child. In such a case, Article 9 refers to person B, the child, as the obligor, the person who is obliged on the obligation. But to keep things simple in my testimony, I'm just going to refer to these parties as the debtor. Security agreement is another very important term in Article 9, and that is an agreement that creates or provides for a security interest. Typically, this agreement is between the creditor and the debtor. When the creditor and the debtor enter into a security agreement and take the steps required for attachment of the security interest to the debtor's property under Article 9, the creditor obtains the security interest that I began by defining, and you get that security interest in those items of personal property that are described in the security agreement. When that happens, the creditor becomes a secured party. The identified items become collateral for payment or performance of the secured obligation. Once the security interest attaches to the collateral, it is effective and enforceable as between the secured party and the debtor. But for the secured party, that's not enough. The secured party knows that there may be other creditors of the debtor out there, or perhaps a creditor to whom the debtor has given a competing security interest, or who has gotten a judgment against the debtor, which judgment has become a lien against the debtor's property. If the debtor defaults on the obligation to the secured party wants to make sure that its security interest in the collateral will win out over competing security interests and liens in the same collateral. In the language of Article 9, the secured party wants its security interest to have priority over competing interests. The secured party wants to be first in line with respect to the collateral if the debtor doesn't pay or perform. Or in some cases, the secured party may be content to be second or third in line, but doesn't want somebody else to be able to jump in front of the secured party who has obtained a security interest in the debtor's collateral. To protect its priority position vis-a-vis other creditors, Article 9 provides rules under which the secured party can perfect its security interest in the debtor's collateral. Perfection is an extremely important concept under Article 9. The purpose of perfection is not only to establish the relative priority of your own security interest, but also to let third parties know of it so that they can act accordingly in dealing with the debtor. The Article 9 rules on perfection are designed to give third parties a reasonable opportunity to find out that you have a security interest in the debtor's property so that the third party won't take such an interest under the false assumption that the collateral is free and clear. Perfection can be accomplished in one of several different ways, depending on the type of collateral involved. The most common way of perfecting a security interest is to file a financing statement in the appropriate public record. This will work for most, but not all types of collateral. Filing a financing statement covering personal property is analogous to recording a mortgage or a trust deed against the debtor's real property. One case where filing a financing statement won't work to perfect a security interest is where the collateral is covered by a certificate of title, such as an automobile or a boat. A security interest in that kind of collateral can generally be perfected only by having the security interest noted on the certificate of title. A second exception to the general rule of filing a financing statement to perfect your security interest is that for some types of collateral, the security interest can only be perfected by taking control of the collateral. An example of a security interest is a security interest in the debtor's bank account. Given the way that people use their bank accounts, it really doesn't work very well or wouldn't work very well for security interests and bank accounts to be perfected by filing a financing statement. So the creditor has to take control over the account, and revised Article 9 defines what that means and lays out the rules for accomplishing it. A third exception to the perfection by filing rule is that for some types of collateral, the secured party may perfect its interest by taking physical possession of the collateral. This is the only way to perfect a security interest in the debtor's cash money. For some other types of collateral, possession is just one alternative for perfecting the security interest. Once the security interest is perfected, the parties have accomplished the goal of creating a secured transaction, and we wait to see whether the debtor will pay or perform as per the agreement between the parties. If all goes well, when the obligation is satisfied, the security interest is terminated, and Article 9 provides the rules on how that is accomplished and establishes consequences for failing to properly and timely terminate the interest. If, on the other hand, the debtor defaults on the payment or performance of the secured obligation, Article 9 details the steps that the secured party can take to apply the collateral to the satisfaction of the obligation. It also provides protections for the debtor and third parties to ensure that the secured party doesn't overreach and treat the debtor or others unfairly, and to establish sanctions where the secured party violates the provisions of Article 9. Well, that's a general and admittedly very hurried overview of the structure of Article 9. As Professor Beer has testified, Article 9 has been a part of our law as ORS Chapter 79 since the UCC was enacted here in Oregon back in 1961. Some of its sections have been amended since then, but most of them have not changed in the last 40 years. As Carl's already testified, several years ago, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, or NACUSL, decided it was time to draft an updated version of Article 9. They've earlier done this with other articles of the UCC, such as Articles 3 and 4, the amendments to which were adopted here in Oregon in 1993. In rewriting Article 9, NACUSL sought to accomplish several things. They wanted to expand the scope of the article so that it would cover additional kinds of personal property, such as a debtor's interest in the debtor's bank account. They wanted to change some of the rules for perfecting security interests, such as where a financing statement should be filed and how control is established over collateral, such as deposit accounts. They wanted to simplify and centralize state filing systems for filing financing statements and related documents, and to encourage electronic filing. They wanted to enhance the rights of debtors in consumer transactions. They wanted to establish new rules for the enforcement of security interests, and they wanted to generally modernize and better organize the provisions of Article 9. Revised Article 9, in our view, accomplishes each of these goals. The scope of the article is enlarged by making it applicable to new kinds of debtors' property, such as deposit accounts and health care insurance receivables, and by making it applicable to additional types of transactions, such as sales of payment intangibles and promissory notes. Revised Article 9 fleshes out the concept of perfecting a security interest by taking control of the collateral. The new article is clear on what constitutes control and how it is obtained, and the use of control to perfect the security interest is expanded from just investment property, such as stock in a company, under current Article 9, to cover other property interests, such as debtor's rights under, a letter of credit or a deposit account. Reflecting the increasingly interstate nature of our commerce, revised Article 9 makes two important changes from current Article 9 regarding the place to file a financing statement in interstate transactions. First, under current Article 9, the law of the state in which the collateral is located will generally govern the perfection and priority of the security interest. Under revised Article 9, on the other hand, the law of the state in which the debtor is located will govern perfection and priority. Secondly, under current Article 9, the location of a business debtor is determined by the location of the debtor's chief executive office. Under the new article, if a business debtor is a, quote, registered organization, and that's a term defined in the new Article 9, such as a corporation or a limited liability company, its location will be the state in which it is created by registration. Revised Article 9 provides that most financing statements will be filed in a single office in each state. For Oregon, that office is the Office of the Secretary of State. Centralized filing simplifies the process that third parties have to go through to obtain information on what, if any, other security interests may exist in the debtor's property. Revised Article 9 also contains provisions designed to facilitate paperless electronic filing of financing statements. For example, the revised rules eliminate the requirement that the debtor sign the financing statement, and that's an important change. They also establish clear rules under which filing offices are to accept or reject records for filing. Many Article 9 transactions involve consumers, either because a consumer owes payment or performance on the secured obligation, or because the collateral securing the transaction is consumer goods, that is, goods that are used primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. Revised Article 9 enhances the protections that are provided to consumers in several ways. It provides that a consumer debtor may not waive the right to redeem the collateral following default. All debtors have the right to redeem, but only non-consumer debtors may effectively waive that right under the revised Article 9. Revised Article 9 entitles consumers to specific disclosure of the consumer's right to recover any surplus resulting from the disposition of collateral, as well as any right the secured party may have to obtain a deficiency from the debtor. The consumer also has the right to receive from the secured party an explanation of how any surplus or deficiency is calculated. New statutory damages are provided in revised Article 9 where the secured party fails to comply with the specific requirements of the article. Where the collateral is sold to the secured party or to someone who is related to the secured party following the default of the debtor, any surplus or deficiency that is occasioned by that sale will be measured not by the price that was obtained through that sale, but rather by the price that would have been obtained in an arm's-length transaction disposing of the collateral. So, for example, if the debtor defaults on a $3,000 obligation and the secured party repossesses the debtor's automobile and sells it to a subsidiary leasing company for a sweetheart price of $2,600, and if the car should have sold for $3,200 in a fair open market transaction, the debtor in that case under revised Article 9 will be entitled to receive a $200 refund of surplus rather than owing a deficiency of $400 resulting from the sale to the related party.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Just a question there on that process. How does the debtor in that case get to that point? Would that be in a challenge to the commercially reasonableness of the sale? Because, of course, this is all extrajudicial. This isn't happening through a court proceeding. Mm-hmm. I guess the debtor would have to know, in your example, that or have reason to believe that the car was worth $3,200 and that they're entitled to some refund and then bring an action against mm-hmm. the secured party, is that it, to establish the value and collect?
That's basically correct. What this does in the way of changing from the previous law is it gives a specific right that doesn't exist in the related party transaction. But yes, the debtor in that situation would first of all have to establish that there was a related party transaction taking place, would have to determine or have a basis for asserting that there the fair market value of the automobile was greater than that obtained in the sale, and would have to bring the action based upon the commercial reasonableness.
I'll just add that related change that the bill makes is to require secured parties, after they've accomplished the foreclosure sale, to send a notice to the debtor explaining the monetary details of what the sale price was, what the other charges like attorney's fees and so on are that are being charged to the debtor and so on. So that gives the debtor a dollar figure to compare the actual results with the expected results. One other facet, if I may, just for a second, Mr. Sherman is talking about, in his example, the debtor claiming a refund. The way this rule might work in a slightly different way is to prevent the secured party from coming after the debtor and suing the debtor for additional amounts that are still owing on the loan. And if that's what happens, right, the collateral fetches less than it should have, so there's still amounts owing on the loan, the creditor would ordinarily sue for the difference, but the debtor, without initiating its own court proceeding, could just raise as a defense to the creditor's suit that
I see.
That it was this was insufficient.
Okay, revised Article 9. Excuse me.
You have a question, Representative Ringel?
And are you saying that the debtor doesn't have that right now to raise that as a defense that the collateral was sold for a insufficient amount?
There.
No, you'd have that right under the commercially reasonable sale rules now, but now you've got a prima facie case if you can establish that the party who acquired the collateral was a related party. Then you've got that leg up, if you will, over
Understand.
The current rules.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Revised Article 9 clarifies that in consumer transactions, the secured party cannot retain the collateral in partial satisfaction of the obligation. And finally, in the list of consumer benefits from this legislation, with respect really to both consumer and non-consumer transaction, revised Article 9 imposes on parties a new objective good faith requirement. The standard of this is that is honesty in fact and observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing. With regard to enforcement of security interests, the new rules require secured parties to notify secondary obligors, such as someone who has guaranteed payment of the secured debt, when there is a default on the obligation. Another new section provides that when a secured party causes repossessed collateral to be sold to satisfy the secured debt, the sale will carry with it the same warranties of title and the like that are part of any other sale under the code. Revised Article 9 also broadens the obligation of a secured party who repossesses and disposes of collateral to notify other secured parties and lien holders having interests in the same collateral so that they can take appropriate actions to protect their interests. Finally, NCUSL has accomplished its goal of improving upon the organization of Article 9. The revised article is divided into six parts, which roughly follow the chronological life of a security interest. Part 1 defines the key terms that are used in the article and those definitions which in the current Article 9 are kind of scattered hither and yon throughout the article are for the most part consolidated into one section, section 9-102. So that should help in locating those definitions. And Part 1 also lays out the general principles of the article. Part 2 covers the effectiveness of security agreements, the attachment of security interests, and the rights of parties to security agreements. Part 3 establishes the rules for perfection and priority of security interests. Part 4 deals with the rights of third parties who are affected by a secured transaction. Part 5 lays down the rules for the operation of the filing system. And Part 6 contains the provisions dealing with the debtor's default and the enforcement of the security interests, along with rules that govern the noncompliance with the requirements of the article. We prepared and submitted previously into the record two documents, and we brought one of those with us today, a section-by-section summary and analysis of our bill. And we hope that that plus the index, which we have previously submitted into the record, will be helpful to you in coming to terms with this complex and lengthy piece of legislation. We also have asked the Senate committee and would also ask you to make NCUSL's official comments that were developed by the National Conference during their drafting of this legislation a part of the formal record of these proceedings. Those official comments are extremely helpful and very lengthy in nature, and they lay out lots of examples of how sections are supposed to work and why they changed from the former version of Article 9. So I think those are extremely important to be made a part of the record of these proceedings. As Carl said, revised Article 9 has been adopted in 29 states now, and the goal is to get this to be the law of the land in all 50 states by July 1 of this year, so that we'll have those rules going into effect across the country at the same time. And it's extremely important for us to move expeditiously here, because those who deal with Article 9 are going to need to go through extensive training to get up to speed with particularly the transition rules that are in this act to carry us from current Article 9 to the new Article 9. Although we call this a uniform act, as Professor Beer testified, each of the states that has adopted it thus far has followed the time-honored tradition of tinkering with the uniform provisions, tailoring them to fit established local customs and practices. And this is not unanticipated by NCUSL. In fact, a number of the sections of the uniform draft, they actually laid out alternative provisions for states to adopt. And that is not unique as to Article 9. Such tailoring has been undertaken with respect to each of the other articles of the Uniform Commercial Code. But with all of that, I want to reemphasize what Professor Beer said, and that is the tinkering is very slight and very technical in nature, and 99.5% of what you see before you is the uniform draft. In assembling this draft for your consideration, our Oregon work group engaged in the tailoring process by including some non-uniform provisions, and I want to call your attention to what I think are the most significant of these changes. First, I want to emphasize again that these changes were carefully considered and agreed to by consensus within the work group. I mentioned earlier the national goal of making this effective by July 1, and we recognized early on that the only way we had a shot at doing that was to work out all of the potential rough points and points of dispute before we got into the legislative session as much as possible, so that we could move this through the process without it getting hung up. There are examples in other states such as Idaho and Colorado where the bill has actually failed to pass in previous sessions because they got hung up on some of the points that we had to consider. We recognized early on that the new Uniform Act's coverage of agricultural liens might prove to be controversial here in Oregon. That's one of the ways that the National Conference decided to expand Article 9, is to make its provisions applicable to non-possessory agricultural liens. And in fact, that was the issue that defeated this legislation in the sessions in 2000 in Idaho and Colorado. Under our current law, in ORS Chapter 87, an agricultural services lien may be claimed against a farmer's crops or livestock when the claimant furnishes labor, material, or services to the farmer. Notices of the lien don't have to be filed until 75 days after the claimant stops supplying the farmer, and then when that notice is filed, it relates back to take priority over a competing Article 9 security interest. NCUSL's uniform draft of Article 9 would expand the article to cover agricultural liens, requiring claimants to file financing statements to perfect their liens and providing that the priority of such a lien would be established by the date of filing rather than the date the lien claimant started supplying the farmer. This would be a major change for the businesses that claim these agricultural liens here in Oregon, and it was clear from the outset that they would vigorously oppose this change. So after careful consideration of the alternatives, the work group agreed to narrow the applicability of revised Article 9 in Oregon by redefining agricultural lien, as that term is defined in the revised article, to exclude ORS Chapter 87 statutory liens on farm products. This leaves in place the status quo on such liens. We simply decided not to deal with that issue in this bill. A second area of change incorporated into this draft involves the responsibilities imposed on filing offices. I mentioned earlier that the most common way of perfecting security interest is by filing a financing statement, and that most but not all such statements are filed with the Secretary of State. With a few types of collateral, such as fixtures, the financing statement is filed with the county recorder in the county where the real property is located. At the request of the Secretary of State and the county recorders, the work group modified some of the time limits in the bill and provided that certain actions will only be required of the Secretary of State and not the county filing officers. Our current Article 9 contains a non-uniform provision that will be phased out under this draft of Article 9. Current ORS 79.4030 requires the Secretary of State's office to send reminder notices to secured parties when their financing statements are about to expire. The Secretary of State wishes to discontinue this requirement, and the work group, after extensive discussion on the subject, agreed that no renewal statements will be required to be sent with respect to financing statements that are filed after July 1, 2001, the effective date for this new Article 9.
Ms. Mosier.
Representative Shetterly.
Are we retaining the 5-year period for financing statements?
Yes, we are, but there's some important transition rules, and I don't have the details right here, but we can certainly get them to you regarding the transition from old to new. And there are some cases where Article 9 financing statements that were filed prior to July 1, you'll have to refile within 1 year following the effective date, the July 1 effective date.
Come back to that, I guess. How happy was the work group to accommodate the Secretary of State's interest in not sending out the reminder notices?
Well, we had quite a bit of discussion about that.
In my experience, a lot of these financing statements are small businesses, you know, filed by, let's say, in sales of small businesses where you don't have the sophistication that you do in banks to calendar the expiration of these financing statements. And then a lot of times, of course, the sale of a small business, for instance, the term of a deferred sale is going to be more than 5 years. And I'm wondering if we're building it back into this trap situation for sellers in that situation where a default may occur after 5 years and they go to foreclose and they find out that they've lost their perfected status.
The Secretary of State's office spoke at some length about the amount of work involved and their perceived risk and concern for liability over the requirement. They also pointed out the fact that Oregon is virtually alone, if not completely alone, in having this reminder notice requirement, and that the NCUSL considered such a provision and rejected it in this revised draft. And as I say, we did have quite an extensive discussion about it, but the consensus of our work group was to proceed with a uniform language on that point.
Representative Shetterly.
I guess as a lawyer representing sellers from time to time, that's always been sort of a security blanket for me, knowing that not only is it my calendaring system, but we've also had the Secretary of State's own system to rely on to make sure that my clients get their reminder. If we're going to do this, I guess we'll let the PLF know that they need to start setting reserves ahead 5 years. Because I'm sure, I can guarantee there will be those cases where the ball gets dropped because somebody now doesn't get that notice out. And granted, a lawyer who's represented a party, assuming that you're represented, should remember to do that, and in most cases probably does, but that notice from the Secretary of State has always been just an extra level of assurance that seller is going to be protected.
Hickler file.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, those were exactly the issues that were raised in the work group discussion.
Okay.
And as,
but the Secretary of State prevailed? I mean,
yeah,
who besides Secretary of State was arguing against the reminder?
Those people in favor of uniformity with the Uniform Act.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
I don't make a big deal of this. This really doesn't have much effect on the uniformity aspect of it. This imposes an obligation on the Secretary of State. It doesn't have anything to do with banks or financers or anything like that. I'm not sure that this doesn't strike me as being particularly at odds in substance with uniformity.
There, I think, if I may intercede, there are some other problems that were mentioned. I remember particularly the Secretary of State said that in this dynamic business world that we live in now, very frequently the financial institution or the creditor, whoever it may be, that filed the initial financing statement no longer exists or no longer exists in the same place. Those are some of the problems that they run into. I think that the other thing that worked in favor of the Secretary of State's position on this issue was the lack of any one of these 30 or 40 people around the table to come up with much in the way of anecdotal evidence that, but for this, they would have had problems. Although it seems logical to conclude that without the reminder system, you would have some of those problems. So it was not an easy issue for us to resolve.
Representative Shetterly?
Well, I was going to say, I've seen it. Thankfully, not having been a party, but I've had situations where we've had people, sellers come in and want to foreclose or to realize on a security interest. And then when we begin to do the research, I could probably think of four or five just in my almost 20 years of practice where I've seen security interests lost because of that lapse of time. Because I know we've not always had the reminder notice requirement.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think that was instituted back in the late 80s or early 90s as a non-uniform change.
If I may, Representative Shetterly, just to make clear that any secured party who currently has financing statements in effect and who maybe is paying less attention to their own calendaring system in reliance on these reminder notices is protected because the Secretary of State is still obligated.
Right.
So it's only after the change in law that...
Right. That's why I said the PLF would mark this down for beginning in 5 years.
One other small thought. I understand your concern, but in terms of traps for the unwary, if you will, yes, the reminder notices are a nice backstop. However, of course, neither you nor I would exclusively rely on those. Anybody that is planning taking the responsibility to plan ahead and take collateral should also be planning ahead to safeguard their own security interest, and that's the best way to avoid, well, one risks falling into a trap by relying on the Secretary of State to do one's remindering for
one. One other question?
One more, Representative Shetterly.
Well, of course, there'll be more, but is the financing statement form provided for? It's not in the...
It is not in the bill, and that was, I guess, more of a printing problem that the Legislative Council's office had. They're going to use the uniform forms that are in the revised official draft, and they will put those out by rule.
I guess my question then is how apparent is the 5-year time limitation identified on the financing statement, and would it also include a notice?
I don't know, a warning to calendar that ahead?
A couple of points on that. Section 92 of the bill does not actually set forth a form of financing statement, but it does refer to a form of financing statement, not one that is mandatory, but one that not one that filers must use, but one that the Secretary of State must accept, so as to allow filers nationwide to know what is needed to get to comply with Oregon's rules. And if you look at the form that Section 92 refers to, I don't believe it has anything explicit about a five-year time limit on it. Ordinarily, financing statements are just blanks to be filled in, and they don't have instructions mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. However, I believe that the Secretary of State's office does have instructions of an informal, non-statutory nature that make explicit that and other rules.
I think.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
Just to follow up on this, was there any discussion as to what type of resources was required by the Secretary of State's office to send out these notices?
I think there was, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think there was discussion about that. And as a matter of fact, Tom Rosch from the Secretary of State's office is here, and he could probably provide more information with respect to these issues and any numbers, financial numbers that you may want.
Let's move on, not right now, but maybe. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed. Go ahead.
Okay. The work group also spent a good deal of time discussing provisions in the uniform draft that pertain to the rights and remedies of debtors in consumer transactions. At least one state, Maryland, simply deleted the new consumer provisions from the bill when they enacted Article 9, and they were one of the first few states that enacted the article. We did not even consider that alternative, but we did tailor the consumer provisions in a couple of areas. We provided that the new statutory damages may be recovered only through individual actions, not through class actions, and that point was simply not addressed in the uniform draft. And we retained Oregon's existing rule on minimum damages in consumer cases. However, we increased the minimum damage amount from $350 to $1,000, and that was as a result of extensive negotiations with the consumer bar. With regard to the consumer debtor's right to recover statutory damages where the secured party has filed an unauthorized record, such as a financing statement that describes collateral not covered by the security agreement, our draft provides that the consumer may recover statutory damages only if the secured party fails to release or terminate the financing statement or the filing within 10 days after being requested to do so. Another change made in the uniform draft by the work group concerns accessions, such as new tires that are installed on an automobile. If one secured party has a security interest in the tires and a second secured party has a security interest in the automobile and the debtor defaults, which security interest in the tires will prevail? Under the uniform draft, the holder of the security interest in the vehicle will win. And that is a departure from current Oregon law, which the work group decided not to follow, They decided to adhere to current Oregon law, at least where the security interest in the tires is a purchase money security interest. That is, a security interest given by the buyer of the tires to secure the payment of the purchase price. In that case, the draft provides that the security interest in the tires will win out over the competing security interest in the vehicle, and that's simply adhering to existing Oregon law on that point. One other miscellaneous issue on which the work group considered but ultimately did not adopt a non-uniform change pertains to the application of Article 9 to the financing of transactions of governments. One of the ways in which the scope of revised Article 9 is broader than current Article 9 is that the present law broadly excludes governmental financing transactions from Article 9 coverage, whereas the new uniform draft provides that Article 9 will apply to such transactions unless another Oregon law expressly provides otherwise. Most of the states that have enacted Article 9 to date have included the uniform language on this issue, but in some more recent cases, modifications to this broad coverage have been made. During the work group meetings, the Municipal Bond Council group argued for changes from the uniform draft, but no consensus was reached on specific changes, and the work group ultimately decided to retain the uniform language with the understanding that Bond Council would consider the introduction of separate legislation to address their specific concerns. We're advised that Bond Council have introduced and will seek the passage of a separate bill dealing with those issues. Finally, since Senate Bill 171 began its legislative journey, the need for additional amendments has invariably surfaced and become apparent. And I'm going to speak to the first of those dealing with deposit accounts and security interests in deposit accounts, and Professor Beer will speak to the second of them. This first issue, as I say, deals with deposit accounts as collateral under Article 9. As I said earlier, the old uniform version of Article 9 was not applicable to security interests in deposit accounts. That didn't mean that deposit accounts couldn't be used as collateral. It only meant that that had to be done under common law rather than under Article 9. Several years ago, recognizing that deposit accounts were increasingly being used as collateral, Oregon adopted a non-uniform amendment making Article 9 applicable to the taking of security interests in all deposit accounts except for checking accounts. The 1993 legislature reasoned, and we believe correctly, that while it made little sense to use Article 9 to create a security interest in a checking account, it was appropriate to make other deposit accounts available for use by their owners as collateral in Article 9 secured transactions. In its new uniform draft of Article 9, NCUSL expands the coverage of the article to include assignments of deposit accounts, but only in non-consumer transactions. The problem with that approach is that current Oregon law allows the creation of Article 9 security interests in non-checking deposit accounts in both consumer and non-consumer transactions. That's the current law in Oregon. And for at least one major Oregon financial institution, the taking of such interests is an important part of its business. First Consumers National Bank, a Beaverton-based bank with over 1,300 Oregon employees, issues bank credit cards that are secured by a pledge of the cardholder's savings account pursuant to current Article 9. The cardholders most frequently use these cards in consumer transactions, that is, in transactions where an individual incurs an obligation primarily for personal, family, or household purposes, which obligation is secured by, in this case, a deposit account that is held by the individual primarily for personal, family, and household purposes. Adoption of NCUSL's uniform language on this point would roll back the clock in Oregon, causing serious problems for first consumers and other creditors that take Article 9 security interests in non-checking account deposit accounts to secure consumer transactions. Oregon's current non-uniform provision has been in effect for the past 8 years. It has worked well, and we believe that it should be retained. To do this, we request that on page 15 of the printed bill, in line 3, after the word account, the following new language be inserted. And let me just give you a minute to find that place. Again, it's on page 15 of the printed bill, in line 3, after the word account. And we would insert the following language, from which, under the terms of the account agreement, third-party payments may be made by check, draft, negotiable order of withdrawal, or other order. The effect of that language is to exclude from Article 9 coverage checking accounts, but to permit Article 9 to apply to other forms of deposit accounts. That additional language will preserve the status quo in Oregon law on this point. And now I'd like to turn back to Professor Beer to talk about the second of the two amendments that we believe is necessary to Senate Bill 171.
Madam Chair? Before we go there, I'd like to just back up a little bit, if I may. You talk about some of the consumer remedies and used an example of the difference in value of collateral that might be disposed, and there are other consumer issues where there may be consumer remedies. and you raise the liability from $350 to $1,000 in the one section. I'm wondering whether you considered allowing an aggrieved consumer the right to recover attorney fees in any of these examples.
Attorney fees? That's in the uniform, isn't it?
Yes, Representative Ringo. Actually, the uniform text that's before all of the 50 states, including in Oregon, allows consumers or other debtors to require to recover their actual damages from an incorrectly conducted foreclosure sale, and those actual damages include attorney's fees. The statutory automatic penalty that's available to consumer debtors without any proof of actual damages is a flat $1,000, excluding attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
But if an actual showing of harm can be made, then absolutely those attorney's fees would be recoverable as well.
And just to follow up, you're saying they're recoverable because they're considered part of actual harm?
Yes, I mean, there's a technicality that I would want to check in the statute as to whether they are defined to be part of the harm or whether they're just a separate recoverable element, but it's clear that they are recoverable.
Okay, and does that say that specifically in the statute, that
yes.
The aggrieved consumer has the right to attorney fees? And
it speaks in terms of debtors in general, so whether
that's
they're
fine.
Consumers or not, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of the panel? Okay,
if I may, Madam Chair, the last amendment that Mr. Sherman referred to, which is currently in the Legislative Council's office, I'll just briefly describe for you and be happy to talk about further if you have questions. It's an amendment to Sections 68 and 70 of the bill. You may actually have the text in front of you. And to describe, this is actually one of the most complicated parts of a very complicated bill, so let me just try to give an overview of what it's about, if I may. Stepping back for a moment, Article 9 covers not just loan transactions where collateral is put up. It also covers, on the fringe of its scope, it covers outright sale of certain kinds of property, specifically property that consists of the right to receive payment in the future. If Ken owes me $1,000 payable next month, that right to receive the $1,000 from Ken next month is property that I own. I don't yet have the money, but I have the receivable. And if we imagine that I want to, instead of putting up that right to receive payment as collateral, instead I want to sell it outright, Article 9 would apply to my sale of that right to payment. Article 9 has always covered some sales of payment rights, and under the revision it's going to cover a broader group of sales of payment rights. The general approach that Article 9 takes is that rights to payment should be readily saleable. We would say there should be freedom of alienation, because the right to be paid is valuable property. And if I would prefer to have cash today rather than the right to receive payment in the future, and on the other hand, a buyer would rather have my right to receive payment instead of the cash, why then let's just exchange what we have and each of us will be better off. That's the way consensual transactions make the economy better off, and there's no reason why that shouldn't apply to rights of payment as well as other property. So there should be exceptions to this freedom of alienation only for good reason. And Sections 68 and 70 generally do is provide for that freedom of alienation to prevail over restrictions on alienation, unless there's a good reason. What the amendments that we're asking for in Sections 68 and 70 do is provide for a couple of what we believe are good exceptions to that general policy, which is to uphold restrictions on alienation of rights to payment under a couple of circumstances. Some of those restrictions on alienation arise by operation of law. Those would be, for example, certain existing ORS provisions where prior legislatures have decided to protect payees from selling their receivables. So the best example would be a workers' compensation recipient who has had serious injuries and is relying on payment, say $10,000 a year over the next 20 years, it would be there's a risk that that person would be improvident and sell all of their rights to future payments today for a lump sum to take advantage of some opportunity that turned out to go sour. And so there is an ORS provision that prevents freedom of alienation in that workers' comp situation. And these amendments would uphold that kind of restriction. There are other kinds of restrictions that are imposed not by law but by contract between the parties. In my example, this would be in the agreement between Ken and myself, we would agree that I wouldn't have the right to sell the receivable. Contractual...
Madam Chair?
Just a moment. Representative Ringo.
Sorry. Excuse me. I just wanted to go back to your example about the workers' compensation benefits assignments. And I'm looking at the amendment. It's 1, then 9, sub B, sub capital A. Is that it?
Yes.
And that references 26 U.S.C. 104.
Yes, Representative Ringo, actually there are two references in the amendment to workers' compensation. One is the one that you're contemplating there in capital A, but the one that I was actually referring to is in the lower paragraph. Let me see, this is Roman numeral 1, 9, lowercase c, where it says subsection 6 of this section does not apply to the following, and you see several ORS references there.
ORS 743.049?
Yes.
And that's the...
No, I'm sorry. No. A little further to the next paragraph after that.
Oh, I see that. Small c.
Yes. Small c and...
The workers' compensation side is ORS 656.234.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. That's right, which is the very last reference in C.
Okay. Just so that I'm clear, there's nothing in this would prevent the assignment of right accruing from an expected settlement in an injury claim.
Let's see, an expected settlement. I mean, of course, if it's just an expected settlement, it's not my property to sell yet in the first place.
My understanding is that some lenders, such as title lenders, that are making aggressive loans based on expected recovery and injury cases.
All right. On settlements in particular, I direct your attention to, let's go a couple of paragraphs up. This would be capital B in the middle of the amendment. So this would be...
That's special needs trust.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yes, it's capital A. I'm sorry. It's getting a little confused here. But the capital A, so 9, lowercase b, capital A.
Right, and that's why that references 26 U.S.C. 104, and
yes.
I have no idea what that
all right.
statute
yes.
says.
Okay, 26 U.S.C. is the Internal Revenue Code. Section 104 is a description of certain assets that do not constitute income for tax purposes.
I see, okay.
And part of the settlement issue that you mentioned is relevant here. Section 104A2 does refer, among other things, to what we call structured settlements, and those involve payment over time.
But if I may just interject, I believe that the amendments that you now have before you would only deal with settlements that are actually in place
that's
and not
here.
With anticipated.
Yeah,
there's nothing here that would impose new restrictions on assignments, restrictions that don't now exist in the law.
That's how it appears to me, and I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you.
I think that we basically covered what I wanted to say about that. As I say, sometimes these restrictions on alienation are contractually imposed, and settlement agreements could be one example of that. The contractual restriction would be there, among other things, for tax purposes. And the decision here to respect those clauses is essentially designed to respect that tax treatment. So in essence, then, what we have is a general policy of free alienation, a few exceptions that we're asking for to override that to respect legislative judgments or contractual decisions that the parties have made.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
Just one more question. You're expanding Article 9 so it includes health insurance care receivables, and I'm just
yes.
I'm wondering about the specific context. It seems to me you've got a health insurer, doctors owed the money. That health insurer should send the money directly to the doctor, not to the
exactly.
patient. Is that
exactly. And that is that's what the statute is designed to facilitate. Of course, that's a very routine kind of transaction. And if you think about it, what it amounts to is the sale by the patient to the doctor of a future right to payment from the insurance company.
Has that been a problem, though, where insurers have been required to send the payment directly to their insured rather than the medical provider, and then the medical provider is left out in the cold?
I haven't looked into the specifics. I wouldn't be able to tell you whether there's been a problem. But in the drafting process, no one was discussing whether it's been a problem. Nonetheless, the fact that it's been working so well, I think, is more a matter of contract and sort of trade understanding. And it hasn't had a firm statutory basis until now. So Article 9 comes along and essentially just provides that foundation and ensures that everybody's clear on how it works.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, if there are no further questions, that concludes our testimony. We very much appreciate all the time you've given us here this morning. We realize this is a very complex measure, and there are others here who may have views that they want to share with you, and hopefully the Secretary of State's office can respond to some of the questions that were raised earlier. But at that point, we are concluded, and we'll be happy to respond to any final questions.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. A couple questions. One is a comment. I have asked counsel to draft an amendment to reinstate the Secretary of State notice requirement. I'd be interested to hear from them, but it seems to me it's a system that's in place. We've already got the software, the process is all there, and we also have the expectation out in the statewide among the people who work in this, and uniform or non-uniform, I think is something that we've come to expect in Oregon. I think it's a nice little touch. And so unless there's strong objection from the work group, my inclination would be to see about reinstating that. And the other, just little ticky little questions. If I may continue.
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
One's ticky, and then the other one I'd like to ask Ken to talk a little bit about the transitional piece of this. But in Section 2 of the bill, we have the definitions and index of definitions. I'm just curious why neither the definitions nor the index, and particularly the index, makes any reference back to Chapter 71 for the definition of a security agreement.
Security interest.
And I receive that's under current law, too. That's a pretty critical definition. Why isn't it even referenced in Chapter 79?
Madam Chairman, Representative Shetterly, that's an excellent question for which I do not have an answer why they did it that way. But, of course, if you look at Chapter 71, the definitional section there
right.
says, as used throughout
but it's
the
funny because but it is funny that this one doesn't refer back.
It gave me a moment of panic when I went looking for the definition and couldn't find it in the article.
Could I also request an amendment just to include that in the index of definitions? Again, it's such a critical definition for the article, for Chapter 79.
I think that's a good idea.
Repeat your request, Representative Shetterly.
If we would amend Section 2, Sub 2, under the list of definitions in other sections, to refer to the definition of security interest back in Chapter 71. I agree with surpluses, I guess, and 71 says it applies throughout the code, but you've got people who are going to be looking at 79, and we may as well make it user-friendly. I think you've done a good job of that in the way this thing flows. I think this would just enhance that in a small way.
Okay.
And one more thing, if I may?
Yes, you may.
The transitional piece, and I think this is in with Section 1. I had it, and I lost it. You talked about, Ken, some security interests have to be refiled, and I see language in here regarding continuation statements. What are we looking at in that transitional aspect of this, and what are the traps there?
You want to speak to that?
If I may
sure.
jump in just for a second, and I don't claim to be at all an expert on the transition provisions myself. As a professor, I don't have to worry too much about that stuff. but just as a matter of clarification, I hope we'll elaborate on some of the aspects. In terms of refiling, as at a first level of generality, I would say most secured parties do not need to refile. Their financing statements that are in place today will continue to be effective for the 5-year period or until that 5-year period lapses. There are cases where the place at which you're supposed to file changes, because as Ken mentioned, you file in the location of the debtor, and currently we define the location of the debtor as where the debtor has its business operations. The revised statute, just in the interest of clarity, because where do you operate? You might operate several places. In the interest of clarity, it says you are located where you're incorporated. And, of course, for some debtors, that's going to be a different state. What that'll mean is that secured parties need to, when it comes time for them to renew, they'll need to renew in a different state. But that is not the same as saying everybody needs to rush out immediately upon effectiveness of this bill and file in the new state. The one situation where a few secured parties might need to pay some quicker attention to revised Article 9 is if they're relying on, as they're very narrow situations, and again here I'm not, they're so narrow that I'm not sure of exactly the contours, but let me see.
It's section 191, there's a 1-year perfection period unless reperfected?
Yes, exactly. And what I think that's getting at is secured parties that today are relying on a method of perfection other than filing. Okay? And moreover, a method of perfection other than filing that works under current law but won't work under revised law. And what those are, boy, Ken mentioned possession of the collateral. That will continue to be effective under the revised law. So they're very marginal situations.
I'm not really prepared to go through part 7 of the thing in any detail. There is discussion, however, in the section-by-section analysis that we've provided to you that hopefully will help. I think it is fair to say that the transition rules that might provide problems are, for the most part, going to provide problems for institutional lenders that are dealing in large interstate transactions.
Don't worry about them.
Yeah, they can take care of themselves. So.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the only witnesses we had on our list. Does anyone else here wish to testify? Hearing is closed, and we are not going to go into a work session today. And being that there's no other business on our agenda, we are hereby adjourned.